Hi, this is Janie Reisner, and welcome again to Women's Voices. Gerda Lerner, a groundbreaking feminist historian credited with developing the nation's first graduate program in women's history, taught in colleges and universities around the world, died recently at the age of 92. When Lerner entered the college in her 40s to study history, she discovered a field that barely noticed her half of the human race. She set out to prove that women have a history, writing books that detailed their contributions and compiling diaries, letters, and other original documents that have become vital sources for other scholars. At Sarah Lawrence College, she established the first graduate program in women's history in 1972. Later, at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, she spearheaded the creation of a doctoral program in the subject. A founding member of the National Organization for Women, Gerda Lerner inspired other women to become activists. The anniversary of Roe v. Wade is tomorrow, January 22nd, and my first guest this evening is journalist and women's health advocate Sarah Erdrich, author of Generation Roe, Inside the Future of the Pro-Choice Movement. Sarah's incisive writings on abortion rights have been noted by Jezebel, Feministing, and the National Partnership for Women and Families. Erdrich's book, Generation Roe, offers the antidote to the usual debates. She insists that it's about time, 40 years after Roe v. Wade, to finally demystify abortion. One-third of all American women will have an abortion by the time they are 45, and most women who have abortions are already mothers. Welcome, Sarah, to Women's Voices.
Well, thank you for having me.
I'm very happy to have you and appreciate your staying up late over there on the East Coast to be here with us.
No problem.
Tell me, what part did, since this is Women's Voices, what part did your mother play in your becoming the woman that you are today?
Well, she played a really big part. It's interesting, my mother grew up in Birmingham, Alabama. She's in her 60s now, so she was growing up there during the Civil Rights Movement. And my family is Jewish, so for my mother growing up, a Jewish woman in the South in the 50s and 60s was a unique experience in its own. And she, as part of the way she grew up, she's always been very outspoken and very forthright in her opinions and very progressively liberal in her politics. And that she really, for both my sister and I, she was always very, very forthright with us that thinking of other people and having empathy for those around us was very important, and just having a lot of kindness, but also intelligence and kind of looking at the world through that lens of being both kind, but also very assertive and questioning. And so she really gave me a very good grounding in women's rights, but also in human rights. That's influenced me, I think, probably more than I realized.
Wow. What a wonderful beginning.
I was very lucky.
What a wonderful sounding mother. That's great. Is your sister on the same path as you?
She is, actually, yes. We're both very liberal and just very, for us, it was never even a question.
Uh-huh.
It was just kind of how we were going to be, and we're both glad for it.
Of course. And the rest of us get to receive that, too. I'm quoting you, I think this is your writing, inextricably tangled in autonomy, privacy, and sexuality, the abortion issue remains home base for the culture wars in America. Yet there is more common ground than meets the eye when so many Americans, in all honesty, have made that choice and want, and many more want to have that choice protected. Reading more about your book, Generation Roe delves into phenomena such as abortion recovery counseling, crisis pregnancy centers, and the infamous anti-choice black children are an endangered species billboard. tells the stories of those who face threats on their lives to pursue careers in this stigmatized field, outlines the outrageous legislative battlegrounds that have popped up all over the country, takes to task pro-choice activists for allowing the very words used in the debate to be controlled by anti-choice rhetoric, such as the term pro-life, and ultimately redirects the dialogue to face reality, speak honestly, and hold abortion up unabashedly as a moral and fundamental human right. And so I invite you to speak on this subject.
Well, those are definitely all topics that I address in the book, which really started out just kind of because I wanted to, I was working for a pro-choice organization, and for me, that really was my crash course in looking at the state of abortion rights in this country. You know, as I just said, I grew up in a very liberal family. I grew up in a very liberal area of the country. And so I thought that I knew about Roe v. Wade. I knew what abortion entailed, and I thought I had a pretty realistic grounding in that aspect of reproductive rights and women's rights and all of that. And then when I actually started working in the field, I realized how little I knew. And to me, it was shocking how many women and families in this country don't have access to a legal, safe medical procedure, how difficult it is, and it doesn't need to be this difficult. And that really, realizing this really started me questioning, why is this so hard? Why has abortion become such a stigmatized word even in our society? And that really, out of those questions and some other events. This was in 2008, 2009, so it was around when Dr. George Tiller was assassinated, so abortion around Obama's first election. So abortion was in the news a lot anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So it really got me thinking about all these questions and trying to, just out of my own curiosity, you know, where do we go from here? It's been 40 years, but it still seems like abortion rights are so tenuous for so many people in this country.
Right.
And what does the future look like given this current reality that no one really thought, you know, Roe v. Wade was supposed to settle this, and clearly it didn't.
Yeah, you know, I've just been astounded in the last few years of the vigor that men politicians have against it. It's just astounding.
Well, exactly, and I think, you know, I feel like that speaks to a very particular kind of arrogance that these politicians think they know what's best for women. Women who, in a lot of cases, aren't even their constituents, haven't voted for them, have not given them the right to make these decisions for them. And I think you saw in the last election cycle, there was a great deal of pushback against some of the more egregious attacks on women's rights. And that is heartening. But the reality is that there are still a lot of restrictions being passed, and there are a lot of battlegrounds that are still kind of bubbling up right now that I think we'll see over the next couple of years becoming more prominent.
What kind of things are you thinking about?
Well, one thing I found very interesting is this idea of the 20-week abortion ban. That a handful of states, I believe it's now five or six states, have enacted that say that that just make it virtually impossible for a woman to receive an abortion after the 20th week of pregnancy. And Arizona did some interesting math, and so theirs is actually after the 18th week of pregnancy because of how they're counting when a pregnancy begins, when the conception begins, and that's a whole different topic that gets into the science and more the medicine side. But the end result is that a lot of women who may need to have a later term abortion are going to find it very difficult to get one in their home state and within a reasonable amount of time. And I think that that's something that a lot of politicians are really seizing upon, because later-term abortions traditionally have kind of a controversial history in this country when you talk about abortion rights?
Well, it's certainly changed from when you just had a doctor that you spoke with and it was decided between you what needed to be done or not done.
Oh, very much. Which is interesting because I think a lot of people, if you ask them, and polls seem to indicate this, they do feel that these are private health decisions that should be made in between a woman and her doctor, and in a lot of cases with the woman's partner as well. I mean, that definitely is a lot of cases. This is very much a family decision.
Right.
And I think a lot of people, that's kind of what they would want for themselves. Yet there's this huge disconnect between these laws that are being passed without a lot of pushback and what people would prefer given their choice.
There seems to be another realm that the government is entering into, and that's pregnancy. Having it monitored or all kinds of things, all kinds of horrible stories of enforced this or that for a pregnant woman.
Oh, very much. It's interesting. Our I feel like, and I noticed this a lot. I have a 4-month-old daughter, so I think I noticed this a lot more when I myself was pregnant. Just how much our society and our culture kind of venerates the idea of pregnancy and family and motherhood, and that's all fine. But the flip side is that for pregnant women and for women, for families with children, there is a lot of intrusion a lot of times, and there's not always a lot of support for either being pregnant or for having a child. And so I think it is a very interesting, you get kind of the flip side of the approach of, on the one hand, there's a sanctity of the family, but on the other hand, the reality can be so at odds with how people feel that it should be.
Although one woman in three has an abortion, and I'm one of those quite some time ago. I know many women who have, so that figure doesn't surprise me at all. But in all this pushback, that's never even mentioned. And that's what you're talking about, that even though we're doing it, we're not supporting it, it seems.
I think that's true, and it can get kind of difficult. I mean, I spoke with a lot of clinic directors and a lot of young activists who had worked in clinics as staffers or counselors. And they all respected the fact that this is a private health decision, that we don't expect people to talk about any other health, any other surgery they have or any other health decision they've made in a public manner. Yet at the same time, I remember one activist saying that, at her clinic, when the patients would come back for their post-procedure checkup, they would have them fill out a survey, if they wanted, about their experience at the clinic and what they could do to improve and just other questions. And one of the questions was, if abortion was illegal, would you have still had this? And she said the majority of the women said, yes, I would have found a way to have an abortion.
Yeah.
And this woman I spoke to said that struck her very strongly, that was for her a reason to keep getting up and going to work every day. That just reminded her of the importance. But she said, on the other side, we need our patients. If they're comfortable, we need them to speak out for us and to help us make sure that other women don't have to go through, to worry about abortion becoming illegal. We need more voices than just ours to be heard.
Mm-hmm. To just see it as a human right, as a right of control over our own bodies.
Well, very much. To me, it's a very fundamental right. I would not want to live in a society that said that they could, that felt that they could tell half of the population what to do with their bodies. I think that sets a horrible precedent for a lot of other personal rights and a lot of other freedoms that we do take for granted.
Yeah. Are you feeling that the young women are ready to step up, the younger coming up generation, to step up to this and make sure we continue to have that right?
I am feeling cautiously optimistic, I would have to say. I think that there are a lot of really wonderful, creative, and determined young activists who are in college and you know, law school, medical school, who are very engaged in this fight. And I have full faith in them. And I also, I think one thing that all the restrictions of the past 2 years, at least, have shown is that they have gotten so much attention, I think people are beginning to realize, oh, abortion, this is not subtle law. This is something that can still be taken away. And so I do think that it's becoming more relevant to a lot of younger women and a lot of younger men, whereas even 10 years ago, 15 years ago, they may not have felt that same urgency. So that does give me a great deal of hope.
Mm-hmm. I think the things that have been so awful that have happened to women through laws, all those examinations, you know, all of that horrible stuff that they tried to enact, really, I'm sure, worked against them.
I think so. I was going to say, I think that this last election cycle, and, you know, just to take a very recent example, definitely kind of showed how far people were willing to let politicians go. And I was glad that there was that much pushback.
In Virginia, protests combined with mockery on late-night TV shows prompted GOP politicians, I think we all saw that joke, to scale back a bill that would have required women seeking abortions to undergo a transvaginal ultrasound.
Mm-hmm.
And the rest, all those ridiculous, really disconnected statements that some of those politicians made regarding rape and women's bodies were just beyond.
Yeah, it indicated a complete lack of sensitivity and understanding. I think a lot of politicians really do seem to think that this is a capricious decision that women make and that they can't be trusted to know their own mind. That's what a lot of these laws do seem to indicate.
Right. Well, I sent you a little article that came out today in the San Francisco Gate. Roe versus Wade, After 40 Years, Deep Divide is Legacy.
Mm-hmm. A very interesting article. Well, I think, you know, I read it over a couple of times today. It covered a lot of great territory. And one thing that really struck me is reading some of the conclusions drawn from various people interviewed. I think that the title is accurate, that there will always be a deep divide about the abortion debate in this country. And I don't think that there's anything wrong with people disagreeing about whether or not abortion is moral, abortion when life begins. I think that those are important discussions to have, and they can be very informative, no matter where you fall on the spectrum. I think where the danger comes in is when someone is trying to tell another person how to live their life and what decisions they should make. So I think it's fine to disagree about abortion. I think that's very healthy. But what's not healthy is these anti-choice legislatures and protesters and activists who are saying, we know what's right for you, and we want to take away this choice because we don't agree with it. I think that's where the danger is.
Yes.
And I felt like this article very nicely illustrated a lot of the different issues that go into that.
Mm-hmm. And I think that there's this religious and moral component that anti-abortion folks embody.
Yes. Which is interesting because it seems they're going with their religion and their morals, and they're trying to enforce them on other people. And to me, that kind of seems to go against some of the principles of religion.
Mm-hmm.
Trying to force your opinion on others doesn't really... It's not how I was raised to think about religion. So I find it very interesting.
Uh-huh. I believe anybody who has an abortion, most women, it is a very difficult decision to come to. I mean, being pregnant and having a baby is a wonderful thing. And to not be able to carry that through is very painful. It's not mm-hmm. capricious in any way. And so for others to not honor that decision that's made in difficulty, excuse me, feels very wrong.
Oh, very much. And I remember, again, when I was pregnant, kind of, you know, really thinking if I wasn't pro-choice before this pregnancy, I definitely would be now, just because pregnancy, it's difficult. It changes every aspect of your life, and I don't think anyone's ever ready for, no matter how much you want it. So I think it's such a personal decision.
Absolutely.
That to try and argue otherwise is foolish, honestly.
Well, it's not taking into account that we're all human beings and have our own personal life to live. And, you know, with issues, we can't project how we feel onto someone else and insist that they believe that.
Exactly. And that's something that I think, again, another one of the activists who I spoke with, we were talking about these topics, and she was saying that it's the idea of empathy that she feels is really lacking in a lot of debates in this country, but particularly among reproductive rights, that the idea of being able to empathize with someone's situation, even if you don't agree with it, even if you want to make the same choices they would make, just being able to put yourself in their shoes and saying, okay, this is difficult and this is personal. And she said that that's a quality that is really missing. And she and I agree with her, felt that was a real shame.
Yeah, I understand. You tell stories, don't you, of people?
Yes, that's correct.
And is that kind of the bulk of it?
It's kind of an even mix. Honestly, it started out the original idea of the book was to tell the stories, not so much of women's experiences with abortion, although I do address that, and there are some very personal stories about why specific women chose to have abortions. But what I really do was humanize the providers and the clinic directors and all the people who, particularly who have grown up with legal abortion and who have entered this field, and why they wanted to do such work, which is still very dangerous and very stigmatized. And so I do tell their stories, among others.
Mm-hmm. An act of bravery to really support and work in that field, for sure. Do you have a website or a way that people might follow you?
I do. I have my website. It's www.sarahurdrich.com.
And you spell your last name?
Sure. It is E-R-D-R-E-I-C-H.
Okay. I know that your book, Generation Row, will be carried by our local bookstore, Gallery Books, in Mendocino as soon as it is published. And it's supposed to be out in March. Is that right?
Yes, March 26th.
Okay. Well, Sarah, thank you so much. It's been wonderful to speak with you.
Thank you.
And I applaud you for your important work and also for having a wonderful time as a mother.
Well, thank you. And I really enjoyed speaking with you.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night. Okay, we're going to have a little music while I bring up my next guest. Thank you.
fight of darkened skies, held fast on our mother's lap. We know her love will be revived. Let all who hear rejoice again. We rise up to the call.
My next guest is Leslene de la Madre, radical feminist, shamanic healer, and author of Midwifing Death, Returning to the Arms of the Ancient Mother. Leslene was born and raised in the Bay Area of Northern California. She graduated from UC Berkeley in 69 and embarked on a deeply spiritual path during the historic Flower Child era. During that time, she began her shamanic initiation into the realms of mind, body, and spirit, and received many teachings and medicines from people, plants, and encounters with the spirit world. She lived on the farm for nearly 11 years, during which time she married and gave birth, naturally, to two daughters who are now grown and carrying on the transmission they received from their mother in their own form. Leslene trained on the farm as a labor coach and assistant midwife, which served her in writing her book about midwifing death. She has touched many people throughout the years and continues to be a beacon for the mother energy, holding sacred space for counsel, ritual, teaching, speaking, and writing. She is dedicated to helping others in awakening to their true nature and to hearing the heart song of the mother, the divine feminine, in all her forms. Welcome, Leslene.
Thank you, Jamie.
Very nice to have you with me, us, once again.
Thank you.
You have just returned from Guatemala.
Yes, I have.
You went with an intent to connect with Mayan women in this time of the new epic, identified among some as the new cycle of women?
Yes, you know, I didn't know that, that is how some Maya think of this new epic. I learned that when I was there, but I must have had a calling, you know, an unconscious calling to go to be in Guatemala at the beginning of 2013. I wasn't really called to the you know, sort of New Age festivals, which most of them I heard were disastrous because the Mayan elders were saying it's because they crossed money with, you know, prayer and on ceremonial grounds. And I wasn't called to those festivals or whatever they were, but I was called to be there. And then when I heard that some Mayan are addressing this new cycle, you know, we're talking about a 26,000-year cycle, which we just completed and are entering on a new one, as the new ethic of women. So then I realized, well, that was why I was called to be there. I didn't know how it was going to unfold, but I just knew I needed to be there.
Mm-hmm. So. You just returned two or three days ago, right?
Yes, uh-huh.
And how long were you there?
2 weeks.
So how was it?
Well, you know, it was an adventure, and, you know, there were a lot of aspects to it. I think to have gone deeper into what my intention was, I probably needed to stay there longer, because the women are not, they're not high profile, and they're not out in front, and, you know, most of the ceremonies are conducted by men, and, like, the big ceremonies are, you know, that went on for the 21st. I didn't go to them, but I know that they are mostly conducted by men.
I see.
So it's not an easy thing to try and find the Mayan women and ask them to speak and to share. And I just sort of touched the surface. You know, I was glad to hear from the mouths of men that this is a cycle for women. I'm not sure that anybody knows what that means exactly, you know, mm-hmm. not to be disrespectful, but just because women's voices globally have been so absent for 5,000 years that I don't think anybody really knows what it means to have this next epic be the cycle of women. I mean, I think I'm so happy it's being spoken, and at the same time, I don't. Much will be unveiled over the next 26,000 years.
Yes. There you go. Women don't know either what that will look like.
No, women don't know either.
No, we're all kind of just feeling our way along.
Yes. I think women are remembering.
Mm-hmm.
I think more and more women are remembering one of the... there are a few women that are doing ceremony, and one woman that I did speak with, a Mayan ceremonial leader, she said that before the Spanish conquest, women had more respect, and I think, I'm not sure how much respect, because the Mayan culture, from what I know, was still a patriarchal culture. It's not a really old culture. You know, the Mayans, the Incans, the Aztecs, they definitely were riddled with patriarchy.
Oh, yes.
But she was able to tell me that she does see that with the Spanish conquest and the Catholic Church, that women became way more oppressed. You know, I asked her, well, what could she share that would be helpful for women to hear, not just Mayan women, but women in general? And basically her message was that we really need to start listening more to the ancestors. And I think that's really important, because I think Western culture, we don't really have a concept of that. We don't really know what that means. We don't really know how to go about doing that. And you know, they do. They definitely do, even though it's kind of all mixed up with the Catholic Church and the conquest and all of that. They do have a strong connection to the ancestors, and that was one of her, I feel like, really important messages.
How do you see that demonstrated? I mean, why did she say that, since they don't speak up? Do you mean they just have a deep spiritual connection?
What was the first part of your question?
That you say that they have a deep, first of all, to pay attention, listen to the ancestors.
And, yes.
But how is that demonstrated? What does that mean? Are they listening to the ancestors? I mean...
Yes, well, from what I gathered from what she was saying, yes, they listen very intently, and they pray. They do a lot of praying in their ceremonies, and they work very closely with the elements. And so she said that women need to listen to the heart of the elements, the heart of fire, the heart of water, Mother Earth, and to pray and listen to the heart of the elements. Hmm. So something that I think we as Westerners need to remember how to do that. We need to cultivate, bring that back. The people that I met, they're poor, and they're very close to the earth, and they live very simply, and they're not complicated like most of us tend to be in Western society. And so they're just close to the elements. They're close to nature. And Westerners tend to not be that close to nature.
Mm-hmm. It's certainly true.
Yeah.
It's a foreign land. I'm speaking with Leslene de la Madre, and author of Midwifing Death, Returning to the Arms of the Ancient Mother. Thinking of meditating and thinking about on fire and trying to bring something out of that into our consciousness it sounds challenging, you know? It seems like that to happen would be an absolute gift.
Renewing our connection? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, yes, and to learn from the spirit of fire.
Absolutely.
To learn to do that.
Absolutely. yeah. I mean, I think her point was that we need to really renew of these connections because it's where we come from.
Yes, it is. We are all mammals. We forget that.
Yeah.
We forget that.
Yes.
You've made two trips to Belgium.
Yes, uh-huh.
And been, you've led workshops.
Yes. And what was the last thing you said?
Could you talk about that?
yes, I was invited to come and speak there and work with a lot of women who are involved in midwifery and doulas and birth, but women who became very interested in midwifing death as part of midwifing. And because it seems that we don't really include that aspect too much when we think about midwifing. We think a lot about birth, which is, of course, you know, natural that we would think that. But so they were interested, a lot of the women there were interested, and they invited me over. And I did some workshops on, I don't separate out death from life, so it's all combined for me, and my focus is on remembering women's mysteries, and so then it went from what are women's mysteries, and you know, the mysteries that of woman that we hold in our bodies, and so I did some workshops about the shamanic remembering of womb wisdom and how that relates to birth, life, death, what's going on in the cosmos, sacred geometry, different aspects of what that is, of what life and death really are, and so much that relates to being female that we just don't give any importance to whatsoever.
Right, like bleeding, like menstruation.
Like yes, bleeding, and even I went. I got into a whole teaching about the Black Madonna and. And my research with that, just at the very root of what that is, what the Black Madonna really is, and you know, I'm a radical feminist, and radical means the root word of radical is root. That's what it means. It's root. So in my research, I feel the ancestors really bring me to the root of whatever it is I'm working with. So a lot of what I am going to offer in a workshop, I'm sort of discovering myself as I go along. And so I've had a lot of aha moments in preparing for the workshops for Belgium, as I was I just had a lot of ahas as I was preparing the PowerPoints and so forth.
How wonderful. Wonderful.
Yes. It's a journey for me. It's like the ancestors are saying, okay, you're going to go over there. And I'm saying, okay, well, I'm not sure what I'm supposed to do. And then it's like I'm being shown because I don't have a curriculum. I don't go around saying, okay, now we're going to learn to midwife death, and this is how you do it. It's more about who are we when we gather in this community of women for the first time, and what is it that wants to be known through us that's living in the moment. And I somehow weave into midwife. I weave midwifing death into that, but it's very organic how it arises.
Mm, mm. That's so, so beautifully put.
Oh, that's sweet. Thank you.
Yeah, because that's I believe what's happening. Absolutely, we are awakening.
Yes, we are. Yes.
And you mentioned the Black Madonna and what she really stands for, and what
yes.
what do you want to say about that?
Well, image-wise, in the imagery, when I was doing my research for that part of the presentation, I realized that if you have an opportunity, I came across an absolutely gorgeous image of the vulva of an African woman. And the imagery of her vulva and the way I looked at it, it was the absolute image of the Black Madonna, with the folds of the vulva, with the way the vulva appeared. It was the Black Madonna. Huh. And then I realized that clitorectomy is the beheading of the Madonna.
Wow. Huh.
Which is what goes on in patriarchy. It is the cutting off of the power, cutting out the power of female magic. And it just leapt out at me. If you look at images of the Madonna, you see all those folds of her clothing. They're labia.
And Guadalupe, I've heard too of her looking like the vulva.
Yes. Yes, I mean it's the gateway of life.
Yes, it is. It is. We don't get that.
No. And we look at it as an object, you know, we look at the Madonna or the image of Mary or whatever we've decided to do with that as this object. But really, when you look at it and meditate on it, you will see that it is the form of the mother, of the Madonna. The vulva is the form of the Madonna. That's what I learned about. Mm-hmm. And then the mysteries of the Black Madonna, I mean, it doesn't stop there. It's like then the entrance, then the portal, it's a portal. And you have the vulva portal, and then you have the cervical portal, you know, the portal of the cervix, the os, which looks like what they call in sacred geometry the torus shape. It's the torus is what they say is the shape of the universe. And then you go in, that's the portal, and then you enter the womb, which is the all. So So this is what my workshops got into, or this is what the ancestors got me into.
And then the monthly bleeding, the blood, the sacredness of the blood, that's the other thing that's so disdained in our culture.
Right.
It's this horrible thing you have to go through once a month and that nasty blood and all of that. But this is life.
Right.
This is where life comes from.
Right. It's the magic of this female world that every single woman embodies.
An animal, mammal.
Yes. Every female embodies. Yes. So. But the animals have the estrous cycle, which is different than the menstrual cycle. The humans are the only beings that have, human women are the only ones that have the menstrual cycle.
Just a note on animals. Female mammals love their offspring just as cows and horses and pigs.
Yes.
All love their offspring just as the same love that we, maternal love that we have for our own.
Yes.
Should give us pause about what we do with them.
I think we humans learn to love from the animal mothers, because they're our ancestors.
Uh-huh. Well, that's true. They are.
Yes. Yes. I think we learned that from them.
You are going to be going to Australia.
Yes.
And you are sponsored by the shamanic something. I didn't
get. The School of Shamanic Midwifery.
How exciting.
Yes. I just need to figure out what the ancestors want me to do there.
When do you go?
April.
And how long will you be there?
1 month.
Wow. What an extraordinary experience.
Yes, I think it will be.
Will you meet?
I'd love to go see. There's Aboriginal women there that are in this sort of central, little bit north Australia. They're called the women of they're the last women of the women's law, of the Aboriginal women's law camp. I don't know a lot about Aboriginal women's law, but I know that it's amazing. And these women are in their 80s. And you've told me about the woman there that is helping them to, you know, keep their tradition alive. And I would love to go see them, but just to get to see them from the nearest city, you have to take three different airplane rides. And then after the last airplane ride, then you have at least a 16-hour drive by four-wheel.
Oh my gosh!
Drive to where they are.
Mm.
So I'm not going to be able to do that.
Yeah, that's too bad.
Did
they have a matriarchal society?
As far as I know, yeah.
Uh huh.
Mm-hmm. Well, they have what they have what they call. Women's law is the highest law, so that everyone lives according to women's law, and the men are educated, or their rituals are governed by learning to live by women's law. And so when the men do their rituals, I don't know a lot about their rituals, and the women and the men don't share their rituals. They don't share that business with each other.
Hmm.
But the little that I know is that with the men, when they do their rituals, they are taught that the earth under their feet is their mother, and they must learn to live by women's law, which I think is pretty astounding.
Well, yes, it is. It's good. It's a good message too. It's wise of them.
Yeah.
It's wonderful.
Well, they're not even allowed to. They're not even considered to be ready to even be in any kind of relationship with women until they understand how to live by women's law.
Ah, I see. Huh. That sounds lovely.
Yes.
I'm speaking with Leslene Della Madre, author of Midwifing Death. You have a website and probably several ways to reach you.
It's a www, and it's leslinedelamadre.com. LeslineDelamadre.com.
Okay, thank you. Your two daughters, you mentioned they are carrying the transmission they received from you in their own form. Could you tell us a little bit about what they're doing, your grown-up daughters?
They have been active in the music world. They formed the all-female collective known as the Goddess Alchemy Project a number of years ago, and they do a lot of spoken word and you know, a lot of their own writing and their own music, and they've performed a lot. They've been going through some changes with their music and their organization for the last year or so. We'll see what emerges.
mm-hmm.
They're finding their own individual paths as well as being together. So we'll see how that blossoms.
mm-hmm. You're leaving in April for Australia. And mm-hmm. and you will be probably in different places in April doing workshops. Is that correct?
Sydney and Melbourne and Brisbane, is I think.
Okay.
And they're not close to each other.
So you get to travel.
Yeah.
Well, that's what you get when you go to Australia.
Yeah.
You know, our time is running out. I thank you so much, Leslie. It's been wonderful always, always to have you.
Oh, thank you. Well, thank you for having me on, and getting to share with your listeners is always a pleasure.
Sing a song to the mother, sing a song to the earth, sing a song of hope and joy, a song.